This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez, in for Matthew Petty. Tensions between police and primarily black communities have consumed the nation in the past few weeks. Shootings by police officers in Minnesota and Louisiana left two black men dead. A sniper gunned down five police officers in Dallas and injured more. The Black Lives Matter movement is becoming more visible in Central Florida, with more demonstrations planned this month. We've seen protesters hit the streets in Orlando. Central Florida has a storied history with the Black Lives Matter movement since the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Sanford in 2012. That's where we began this Friday News Roundtable, and we're taking your calls. What has changed in police-community relations since the Trayvon Martin case? How are Central Florida police departments doing when it comes to community policing? What has been your own experience with local law enforcement? Weigh in by calling 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Or send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Joining us is Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Frank, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Mike Lafferty, freelance writer and former editor at the Orlando Sentinel. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
And Maria Padilla, founder and editor of the Orlando Latino blog. Maria, great to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start in Sanford. In the wake of recent police-involved shootings, Black Lives Matter protests are scheduled across Central Florida. A jury acquitted Neighborhood Watch member George Zimmerman of the 2012 killing of unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. Fast forward to today, and one activist tells us racial tensions are still running high in Sanford. Local activist Frances Oliver is also a candidate for the Seminole County Commission. She explains the balancing act Sanford police must practice in the community.
The police in Sanford have a double duty. They have a duty to serve and protect, but they also have a duty of community relations. The serve and protect are the citizens that are doing right, the citizen that needs services and protect. And then you have the other side over here who feels like the police is harassing the really poor people, the homeless people, the young people, especially young black men. They feel like they are being harassed by the police.
Current Sanford Police Chief Cecil Smith took the job after his predecessor was fired over the department's handling of the Trayvon Martin case. Deputy Chief of Police Darren Scott has been with the department for nearly 28 years. He applauds Chief Smith for the work he's done since taking over.
He has connected with the community a lot more so than before. He's very community oriented, and our philosophy right now is to try to get in touch and stay in touch with the community as much as we can. Of course, you're never going to please everyone.
Mike, I want to start with you. Take us back to the shooting of Trayvon Martin. What were the criticisms over how the former police chief handled the investigation?
Well, the key criticism was that the investigation was kind of lazy and sloppy. They, for example, didn't interview some witnesses for quite some time, some key witnesses, including someone who said they heard the fight that was going on between the two men. They didn't even go get cell phone records for Trayvon, which later were presented to the police by Trayvon's father, who said, look, this guy was on the phone with his girlfriend most of the time. This was up until the point this was happening, which might have suggested that he really wasn't up to anything nefarious. So anyway, those things happened. Probably Lee's biggest offense, though, was the fact, in a lot of people's minds, was the fact that there was no arrest made. And, you know, a lot of people saw this as, you know, a guy with a gun shot a kid who did not have a gun. How can you not possibly not make an arrest? So and then from there, of course, the departure of Lee was of kind of this tortured process where Trayvon is shot in February. Lee is placed on paid leave in March. He tries to resign in April, but the city commission rejects his resignation by 3-2 vote. And finally, in June, the city manager's had enough, and he fires chiefly.
The Trayvon Martin case spearheaded the movement for racial equality when it comes to policing and is credited for really kicking off the Black Lives Matter movement. What was the community's reaction to the verdict?
Well, if you read the stories leading up to the verdict, and I went back and read some of them before this show, and there were predictions that there was going to be a lot of trouble. People were suggesting that if there was a not guilty verdict, you could expect to see people rioting and all sorts of terrible things happen. But as it happened, the verdict came in. It was not guilty and not a thing happened. Everything that followed was peaceful. Although you did see that at first, just what was a hashtag, Black Lives Matter, emerging, and it's now become a movement.
Maria, Black Lives Matter protests and vigils are scheduled throughout Central Florida this month. How would you characterize the relationship between the police and minority communities here in Central Florida?
I've always thought that the relationship between police and the community depends on who you are and where you live, because there are communities that may have a much larger presence of police, and there are communities that may have no presence of police. And there are, if for instance, the Black Lives Matter's contention is that black youth, and particularly young black men, are far more sort of either watched, patrolled, stopped than other folks in the community, and that makes for a touch-and-go relationship. Having said that, I've also thought that Black Lives Matter to some degree is a little misunderstood. People think that Black Lives Matter means that Black lives matter more, and I've never understood that way. I've always thought that it really means that Black lives should not be diminished, as in fact they have been throughout most of history in this country, you know, touch and go here and there. So I think that that's really what it's all about.
Talk some more about some of the things local activists are hoping to change when it comes to local police community interactions.
I think one of the biggest things has always been more interaction with the community. And by that, most people, I think, mean to have police get out of their cars. It's a little difficult to do that in suburban communities because everything is not centralized and everything is quite dispersed and far away. But I think that really is central to community policing, which is that the police have to be known to the community. The community has to know the police, and therefore you really can't do that much in a patrol car.
Florida's quite a transient area. How does that affect the way police do their job here?
What it means is that police have to get to know their communities over and over and over again, because it's not a steady, it's not a place where the population remains steady and known to you. It is a place where you have constant influx of new people and constant departure of the ones that you knew. So you have to constantly reintroduce yourself to the community all the time in Florida.
Interesting. What has been your experience with local police? Is there room for improvement in your community? We're interested in hearing from you. Call Intersection now at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Frank, in the wake of the shooting deaths of Dallas police officers, Florida House Representative Dennis Baxley is proposing Blue Lives Matter legislation to classify any act of violence against a police officer as a hate crime. What are the chances the House takes this up?
I think they're going to take it up. I think it's a very popular, of course, we have a conservative state legislature, and the policy, or at least the initial message behind the proposed legislation plays very well with them and reinforcing the importance of protecting police. So I think it'll get heard, and I think it stands a very good chance of passage. Of course, we've still got to see what the exact details are and all the other circumstances behind the pitch. But from early on, it sounds like something that would play well in the legislature.
But you know, one thing about it is, if I'm not mistaken, this would be the first time that in Florida, at least, that a hate crime has addressed a group of people by their vocation, as opposed to some other identifying factor, right?
Yeah, I think that would be accurate. And, you know, it's And given this particular vocation, I think there's a chance you could even see it spread into other first responders as well. People want, especially after the events in Dallas, I think that there's enough of a hunger there to make sure that that the police are, the proper measures are being taken to make sure that violence is being prevented against the police as well.
Maria.
I also find it rather ironic, though, because if you look at the history of hate crimes and whether or not there would be statutes on the book about hate crimes in any given state, that has mostly been a push by Democrats, not by Republicans. Republicans have always stated that a hate crime is a sort of redundant because whatever crime has been committed is already covered by an existing statute. And here you have Republicans now wanting to promote a new hate crime or in addition to the hate crime statute that we may have. So I think the whole thing has become upside down.
Florida already has tougher penalties for those who commit acts of violence against police, right?
Along with the basic, judicial or outlook of a crime committed against police and violence against police in general, there is some, I'm not sure if there's exact language or legal language that prohibits that. But, I mean, generally, you commit violence against a cop, you're going in with the deck stacked against you no matter what your situation is.
Maria, do you know what police interactions with our growing Puerto Rican community and other Latinos has been like?
I have only heard scattered complaints here and there about perhaps adolescent or young Latino men being profiled or being stopped or whatever that you might hear, for instance, in an African-American community. But I haven't heard anything really anything really big that has happened within the community, as far as I know. And when you look at police complaints in Orlando, at least, there haven't been that many sort of excessive force complaints. If you look at 2015 numbers, there were only like 9. Now, that's not always completely accurate because many people never file complaints. But 9 complaints in the city of Orlando does not appear to be too bad.
We heard the Dallas Police Department chief said to the community, "We're hiring, come help us serve your own community." What do Central Florida police departments look like? Do police forces mirror local communities here?
They do somewhat. Some of the communities do. If you look at Orlando, for instance, the chief is not a minority. But if you look beneath him in the under, I forget what the exact title is, they have 4 sort of deputy chiefs, and one of them is Latino, and one of them is Black. If you look at the Orange County Sheriff's Office, well, obviously you have a Black sheriff in Orange County who actually was just named head of the Florida Sheriff's Association, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a first. And when you look who is, under him, you see that there is a Latino who's been in the force for many, many years. I think his name is Ray Rivero. He's been there for like 30-odd years. And logically speaking, in the hierarchy, he might be sort of the next person to take the top position. Outside of Orlando and Orange County, you don't see a whole lot except for like Sanford, where the police chief who was in place during the Trayvon Martin shooting was replaced for reasons that Mike stated. But outside of that, you don't see a whole lot.
All right. We have a caller to go to. John is calling us in Orlando. John, you're on the air. John, can you hear us? Hello? All right. Maybe he can give us a try back. Mike Lafferty, what role does the media and social media play in addressing racial divides?
I'm glad the question separates media and social media because they're very different creatures. The media's job is essentially to be a either a spotlight or a mirror, however you want to think of it, as on the community. So It's a reflection of what is happening in the community. There are some people in the media maybe who are have the privilege of extending opinions about these things. But generally, the media is reporting what is going on in the community, sometimes the obvious, sometimes the not so obvious. The social media aspect of this, though, is very different. You have people. It really kind of depends on who your circle of friends and social media are. So I have on Facebook a circle of friends who are fairly positive people who talk about people being united and that sort of thing. But I know there are people out there who run in, whether it's a Twitter circle or a Facebook circle or whatever social media application it is, who are surrounded by people who are advocating violence against police officers, or on the other hand, people who may be like having a white supremacist as their Facebook friend. So it really carries I would have to say that, in my opinion, social media can play a key role in dividing people because of that.
The shooting of Philando Castile in Minnesota, records show his final traffic stop was at least the 52nd time he'd been pulled over in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area since 2002. Do we see disproportionate numbers of minorities stopped by police in Central Florida?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I have not seen any sort of analysis by a news organization of that, although you maybe have given somebody a good idea for a good in-depth piece. But, you hear anecdotally all the time, nearly anyone who's black will tell you of their experiences of being pulled over what seemed like a crazy number of times. I haven't been pulled over by a police officer probably in 25 years. I don't know if it's because I'm white. I don't know what it is, but I haven't. But you get people like the senator from South Carolina, who is a conservative Republican, by the way, who said in recent days that he in one year was pulled over 7 times. That's a lot. So I think anecdotally, you hear of it all the time. And where there's smoke, you got to believe there's fire.
Frank, really quickly, as a political observer, what role do you think the rhetoric of this election has had on recent events, if any?
Oh, it's been politicized almost immediately now. You know, between tragedies, there used to be a buffer where, you know, it'd be days or even weeks before politicians would start making it. Now you see email blasts immediately. And I think criminal justice, a lot of the foreign policy events around the world, they're immediately instant game for political points. And you're going to see candidates from all level of governments try to seize that momentum or political capital as soon as possible.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Crystal Chavez in for Matthew Petty. Coming up, Representative Corinne Brown was indicted on corruption charges. She pleaded not guilty. Will we see a change in that congressional seat this election? But first, algae is taking over Lake Okeechobee and beaches in South Florida. Is it affecting you? If you live near the Indian River Lagoon, are you worried about toxic algae? And will this be a catalyst for change in how the state handles its water releases? Who do you think's to blame? We're taking your calls, and we want to hear from you, the listener. 1-866-228-5252. That's 1-866-228-5252. Or you can tweet us at WMFE Orlando. Intersection returns after this.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, treating patients when a medical emergency strikes in 10 emergency rooms throughout Central Florida, including the newest location in Lake Mary on Reinhart Road. Florida Hospital provides a network of care to help treat cardiac and stroke patients when every second counts. More information is available at floridahospital.com/ER.
Good morning, I'm Nicole Creston, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day. Download our WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices. Just search WMFE in the Apple Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Rumberger, Kirk, and Caldwell. Trial attorneys meeting the litigation needs of the business community. Offices in Orlando, Tampa, Tallahassee, Miami, and Birmingham, Alabama. Learn more at rumberger.com. Rumberger, Kirk, and Caldwell. Litigation. It comes naturally to us.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. Joining me in the studio is Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer, Mike Lafferty, freelance writer and former editor at the Orlando Sentinel, and Maria Padilla, founder of the Orlando Latino blog and former editor of El Sentinel. Maria, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Blue-green algae continues to plague Florida's Treasure Coast and is creeping onto the West Coast. If you have something to say on this issue, you can call us at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You know, the bloom can be seen from space, and on the ground, people living a few miles away can smell it. Blooms like this kill seagrass that manatees and other wildlife eat. Carla Vianz and her husband live along the St. Lucie River. At the bloom's worst, she says it's smell permeated her bedroom. She describes the smell as something like hydrogen sulfide mixed with the smell of excrement and dead fish.
This is a kind of smell that you can't get used to. It's not like a farm smell that you can get used to over time. It's a very strange smell. And all I have to do is look at a picture of these TC Palm articles of the bright green algae, and my brain brings back the smell, and I can smell it again, even though I know it's not there.
She and her husband plan on moving in August from the riverfront home where they've lived for 3 years because of the foul-smelling bloom. Meanwhile, area businesses say they're being affected. 54 businesses from 7 counties told the governor's office their sales are suffering from the bloom. The SBA said it's opened up a recovery office in Martin County. Have you seen the algae bloom? What does it smell like to you? How do you want your local leaders to handle the water in Florida? Join the conversation. You're invited to call 1-866-338-5252 or send us a tweet and we'll read your question or comment on the air. Mike Lafferty, we've seen environmental crises over the years, most recently that massive fish kill in the Indian River Lagoon. How is this time different?
I should preface the answer by saying that I'm not a scientist and I don't play one on the radio either. But, you know, these algae blooms are kind of different by their very nature. So what you're seeing on the Treasure Coast and now on the west coast of Florida is a result of these releases from Lake Okeechobee, which, you know, as we know, is the water is held back by a huge dike, which is in ill repair. And the dike gets high enough and the Army Corps of Engineers has to release water or it risks a breach in the dike, which we remember from our history back in 1928, killed thousands of people when a hurricane came barreling through. So this polluted water, which is picking up all this nasty stuff from the agricultural areas to the north, is now going out canals directly into these waterways. So, but then separately from that, you have these other algae blooms that are popping up, like in the Indian River. In Volusia County, fish kills, Brevard County, they're seeing manatees that are dying. And in previous years, they had a huge manatee kill because of an algae bloom. Whether this is any different in terms of how long it lasts or how widespread it is, I'm not really qualified to say. But you are seeing a lot of attention being given to it this time. And of course, as with most things, there are all kinds of politics surrounding how to address it.
The algae issues stem from how water managers handle the release of water from Lake Okeechobee. But interests, including U.S. Sugar, have a stronghold on how land around that lake is used and what kind of pollutants make it into runoffs. Maria, do you see change coming in the relationship between Big Sugar and the states?
I think people have been wanting a change between the government and Big Sugar in the state of Florida. But I think that's been a sort of a long time coming. I'm not sure that we're going to see any dramatic change right now. Big Sugar is a very big lobbyist in the state of Florida. They pump a lot of money into state and local campaigns. The Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times just did a really good story about how much money they've actually pumped since, I think, 1996, something like $57 million. That's not chump change. That is a lot of money. And therefore, people pay attention to the folks who have a lot of money to throw around like that. So I don't foresee a dramatic change. Obviously, they do have to address the issue, but I'm not foreseeing anything dramatic.
With something so visible such as the algal bloom, do you think elected leaders will tackle it any differently?
Again, I think that they're going to have to address the issue because it does affect Florida. It does affect people who live here. It affects the public perception of whether they can come to Florida and actually bathe in a beach. There are a lot of things that are in the mix, but I would not look for anything overly dramatic.
We have a tweet from Beverly Rogers who says, who do you think is to blame? This kind of mentality pits one group against another. How about what do you think would make things better? That's her question to the panel.
Well, you know, there was a plan to buy tens of thousands of acres south of Lake Okeechobee that is currently being used as or is owned by the sugar companies. Sure. And it was this really complicated system of reservoirs that they were going to move that water from the lake into so that it could have a more natural way of filtering as opposed to just dumping it in these canals where it just goes as a straight shot to both coasts. But, you know, the state dumped that idea of building these reservoirs or acquiring the land. And, you know, that's become a flashpoint for this is why did the state decide to do that and what are the consequences long term?
Yeah, that's the whole history of water quality in the state of Florida, which is that you have a lot of stops and starts. Mm-hmm. You have a great idea. You have a constitutional amendment that says we ought to buy land, we ought to spend X amount of money or whatever. And then there always sort of something comes in the way to stop that, to stop the momentum, to slow it down. And of that land buy, I don't even think 30,000 acres were bought over time. And the original idea was maybe 200,000. So obviously there's a problem. There have been some attempts to fix the problem, including by voters. But the voters' will has been in many ways upended several times throughout the years.
What do you think? Is the state paying enough attention to the algae bloom problem, or are they just paying lip service? Are you dealing with water quality issues in your own backyard? Join the conversation. We want to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252. Frank, politicians have descended on the scene promising action and change as the bloom looms on. Are we seeing, what kind of action are we seeing from state leaders?
You know, I think we might actually see some motion on state leaders. I get questions a lot. Will state leaders act? Will they act? Will they not act? I think this time they will because it affects the pocketbook. You can see the bloom from space. That does not play well for Florida's tourism industry. And when it doesn't play well for the tourism industry, it hurts the bank. And when it hurts the bank, everybody's going to be concerned. So I think there will be a call to action to get it fixed because it affects at the very core of the debate the state's image and possible income possibilities. And whether they're doing it for environmental reasons as opposed to fiscal ones, that's another matter entirely, but I think we'll see some action here. Probably in the next in the legislative session.
An email from Congressman Patrick Murphy's office was leaked that shows Murphy's office asking for an announcement of business aid to be delayed until Murphy held a press conference. Republicans pounced on this. Has the algae bloom become a political football?
Oh, yes, it's become a political football. That's why you see politicians by the droves taking, boat trips out and visiting the waters. It's going to be something that everybody's going to get in front of because it's simple. There's a clear enemy. The enemy is the algae bloom. And it's easy for lawmakers and candidates for office. Keep in mind, we're in the middle of election season to get out there on the shore and say, we have to stop this bloom because the bloom isn't going to debate back. So everybody agrees what the solution is, which makes it, ripe for political discussion.
Governor Scott called for President Obama to declare a federal state of emergency. What resources is the governor hoping for, and will it happen?
Whenever a classification or a declaration like that is made, it opens up more resources on the federal level that gives state lawmakers and state officials more tools to work with. And, this is an interesting dynamic between Rick Scott and the federal government who have a terrible relationship on everything stemming from previous requests for declarations of emergency and to Medicaid funding. Washington doesn't care very much for Rick Scott, so it'll be interesting to see how the relationship between the two entities work.
Maria, you want to chime in?
I just wanted to chime in that we can't overlook the fact that under Rick Scott's administration, the Water Management District budgets have been cut significantly. And that affects monitoring and any kind of initiatives that you can undertake. In addition to that, the environmental department resources here in Florida has also been sort of their teeth have been extracted to some degree, so they're a little bit they're toothless, and they're not really as strong as they used to be. So there's a lot that could be done here in our own backyard before we start blaming the federal government.
Well, and it's not just the budgets that were cut. If you look at the makeup of the people who are
on
the water management district boards,
the
appointees, the gubernatorial appointees, they are much different from how they used to be. Used to be there was kind of a mix of people in the development community, agriculture, and the environmental community. Try finding an environmentalist on many of these boards these days, and you're going to be looking long and hard because they're not there.
And Mike, how about this? When this algae bloom leaves the news cycle, does what happens to the political will? Do people just forget about it and move on to the next headline?
Yes. Yeah. I still believe that to the people of Florida, and Amendment 1 was a good example of this. It won, I think, 70%+.
That's right.
People in Florida still care about the environment a lot. But that is not necessarily reflected in the philosophy of the people they're electing to public office, the ones who actually make decisions. So I think the people who are in public office know this. They know that something else will distract the voters. But I still believe, though, there is that fundamental caring about the environment here. And I think that eventually will start to make a difference in who gets elected.
Definitely something we'll be watching on the Treasure Coast. And our own Amy Green is visiting the areas affected by the bloom. We'll hear her reports next week. Moving on, it's been 1 month since the mass shooting at Pulse nightclub that left 49 dead. As the community moves forward, activists are using it as a springboard to push for tighter gun control laws. Earlier this week, activists staged a sit-in at Senator Marco Rubio's Orlando office, saying the senator and his colleagues aren't doing enough to prevent future mass shootings. Ana Escamani is part of the nonpartisan coalition that organized the event. She says the group asked lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to take a serious look at the nation's gun laws.
I know it's difficult to find common ground, but we can all agree that too many people are dying and that we need to do something about it. And a decision to do nothing is a decision.
That sit-in, scheduled to last 49 hours, an hour for each of the victims, came to a premature end when Orlando police arrested 10 protesters for refusing to leave the lobby after the close of business. Frank Torres, the protest happened at the office of Senator Marco Rubio here in Orlando. Do you think he got the message?
I think he heard the message, but I don't think it's going to provoke any action. The truth is that Washington is so gridlocked over any sort of gun legislation, whether you're talking about a ban on assault weapons, the no-fly, prohibiting people on the no-fly, FBI watch list from buying weapons, extended capacity magazines. There just isn't any sort of consensus on anything there, except possibly some action against mental health and trying to stop the problem at its core. So there were many of these demonstrations taking place across the country. But at the end of the day, and until it gets to Washington, until votes are starting to be swung, it's going to be very difficult to see any motion.
And there have been multiple attempts at the national and state level call for a special legislative session here in Florida, the sit-in on the House floor in D.C. Republicans say gun restrictions are not the answer to mass shootings. Will they budge?
Right. I don't think they will. There's a philosophical debate between the people that want to see change for gun control rules and people that want to crack down entities like terrorist organizations that they believe are at the center of the discussion and really the problem. So there's two different philosophies in addition on top of the actual gun control debate that you keep seeing play out in Capitol Hill. And, you know, these tragedies keep taking place all over the country, but we just come back to the same discussion and the same results.
Should elected officials put more restrictions on who can buy a gun? What do you think should be done to prevent mass shootings in America? Are you buying a gun to protect yourself and your family? Tell us your thoughts on this issue. Call us at 1-866-888-3986. 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Or send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Mike, the protest at Rubio's office ended with 10 arrests. Protesters didn't finish their sit-in. What do you think about this message reaching lawmakers?
Well, I think lawmakers had to take notice of it. I mean, they'd have to be having their heads buried in the sand not to see it. But whether it's going to have any kind of effect, I think, is a different thing. You know, protests like this, a lot of times, they're not something where you get an immediate result. But it happens enough. It happens enough, and opinions can start to change. So I don't know if this message is lost on lawmakers, or if they just they probably, if they don't agree with it, they'll choose to ignore it for as long as they can.
We've seen too many mass shootings in the past few years, from the elementary school in Newtown to the movie theater shooting in Aurora. Is Pulse any different?
Well, yes and no. You know, it's no different in terms of how heartbreaking it is and how random it seems to be. It's a little bit different in that the other examples you cited in Newtown and Aurora, those shooters didn't seem to have some political motivation behind it, nor were they, as far as we know, investigated by the federal authorities in the manner in which Omar Mateen was. There was an interesting story in the Sentinel this morning about the range of that investigation. So it is different in that sense. But many other things remain the same. The ability to obtain and use the types of weapons they used, and the ability to inflict just terrible carnage in really a relatively short amount of time.
Maria Padilla, two communities were particularly affected by the Pulse shooting, the LGBT community and the Latino community. How are the two coming together in the wake of this tragedy?
Well, when the tragedy first struck, I think there was a division. There was a sort of, they were at loggerheads to some degree, because there seemed to be some sort of, movement is too strong a word, but there was not sufficient acknowledgement that many of the victims were Latino, although we also know that many of the victims were also LGBT. And so many in the Latino community felt that their ethnicity of the victims was being downplayed in order to, to highlight the LGBT angle. And so what many people question is, why are they mutually exclusive? You can be both. You are, in fact, both. So why not? So I think I see a little bit more of a bridging of that, people coming together. I think the vigil, the Spanish language vigil near City Hall that the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce put on, helped to bridge that a little bit, because it specifically recognized the Latino ethnicity of many, many of the victims. And I think that, some people in the community like that.
Do you see gun control advocates trying to leverage the attention of these two groups to get on board and push for gun legislation?
Well, I have seen some in the LGBT community. Some groups have been much more active in pushing for gun legislation, calling for a special session on gun legislation in Florida. Not successfully, as we know, there will be no special session for any kind of gun safety measure in Florida. But yes, when you have action such as this, when you have some sort of incident like this, it always will push some people to call for some action, not to just let it pass.
We'll pick up the discussion when we return. Coming up, Congresswoman Corinne Brown indicted on fraud charges. Is this political theater, or could we see a change in that seat? And new polling has Trump and Clinton neck and neck in Florida. Where does the purple state swing? We're taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252. That's when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Creality School of Art, a leader in community-based visual arts education since 1975. Classes for youth and adults offered in painting and drawing, ceramics, sculpture, digital and film photography, fiber arts, jewelry, and glass. Registration for summer classes is available at creality.org.
This is Intersection. Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston. Thanks for joining us on your Friday morning. You can check in with us throughout the day by going to our website, WMFE.org, or follow us on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Don Mealy Sport Subaru, dedicated to helping Central Floridians select vehicles that fit their lifestyle and driving needs. Sport Subaru believes love really is what makes a Subaru and aims to impart transparency along the way. Don Mealy Sport Subaru, providing a customer-centric buying experience without pressure or dealer fee. Online at sportsubaru.com.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez in for Matthew Petty. Joining me in the studio is Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer, Mike Lafferty, freelance writer and former editor at the Orlando Sentinel, and Maria Padilla, founder of the Orlando Latino blog. Last week, Congresswoman Corinne Brown and her chief of staff, Ronnie Brown, were indicted on federal fraud charges. Federal prosecutors allege Brown and her chief of staff misled donors while soliciting donations for One Door for Education. That's under, they say, it was a guise of funding scholarships for minority students, raising more than $800,000. NPR's Greg Allen reports the prosecutor says the funds were diverted to Brown's account. All the money raised, the 24-count indictment states only $1,200 was awarded as scholarships. A large part went to underwriting lavish events. The two pleaded not guilty to the counts. Frank Torres, as someone who covers politics and Congresswoman Brown, did the news come as a surprise to you?
Unfortunately, no. Corinne Brown's been in office for a long time, and nothing would surprise me at this point. She's always been one of the more controversial figures in Florida politics, and to have this sort of information come out, there had been some speculation there that this had been going on for some time. So just to finally see it break this way, and to see the way she's reacted to it with defiance, saying she's being prosecuted because she's black, is just more of the same with the when it comes down to the Corinne Brown legacy.
Walk us through some of the allegations in the indictment.
Well, donors were giving this organization's money to fund scholarships for younger individuals, and Corinne Brown allegedly was using it for personal lavish expenses, and the exact expenses include everything from trips to personal expenditures. And at the end, the investigation finally summarized with the indictment.
What repercussions could this have for her reelection campaign?
Corinne Brown has had challenges, maybe not this severe as before, but she's always been a candidate that has always walked into elections with various issues regarding whether it's her conduct behind the microphone at press conferences, her attendance record in Washington. Everything just seems to come down to Corinne Brown at certain times, but she keeps surviving. So, yeah, and she's in a new seat. There are more challenges facing her, but I wouldn't put her re-election chances out of reach completely.
What do you think of the fraud allegations? Should the Justice Department take a closer look? You can tweet us at WMFE Orlando. Maria Brown is striking back. She told reporters the agents investigating her should have spent more time investigating the Pulse shooter, possibly preventing the tragedy. What do you make of that claim?
Well, there is no connection between one thing and the other, number one. So I would call that changing the subject, which is, I think, something that Corinne Brown is actually quite good at. And I think that it is something that resonates to some degree with some of her constituents as well. Unfortunately, it is not the first time that Corinne Brown has been, any allegations have been made against Corinne Brown. She has had other congressional ethical charges made against her, which one of which in the early 2000s involved a West African businessman and the gift of a car to her daughter. And those charges eventually were kind of not charges, but those allegations were dropped by Congress. So time and again, we do see that these sorts of things pop up in connection with Corinne Brown.
Mike, Brown has held that seat since 1993, and she's up for re-election, as we said. But recent redistricting and now these allegations of fraud seem to be stacking the deck against her. Is there any way Brown makes it through this and wins?
Oh, sure. There's heavens, yes. She could win. I'm not saying she will, but she has truly been a survivor even amid some of these things that maybe would have been the end for some other politicians. The new district is a bit of a wild card. She'd been dealing with the same district for a long time, that weird snaky thing that went all the way from Jacksonville down to Orlando. Such a strange district. Now this one's slightly less strange. It goes over towards Tallahassee, and she has a real opponent in Al Lawson, who's a respected state legislator, or was. But, you know, never underestimate the electorate's ability to elect people despite scandal. I mean, you look at people like David Vitter and Charlie Rangel and Marion Barry and Barney Frank and Mark Sanford, the Appalachian Trail fake hiker who just recently got reelected back to Congress after leaving in disgrace.
Frank, tell me about the candidates running against Brown and how their campaigns are capitalizing on this.
Well, you have Al Lawson, a former state lawmaker who's ran unsuccessfully for Congress before. And, you know, he is getting some sort of he is getting a push behind this. His messaging is sort of the clear alternative. And what makes it interesting is that he's talking to a different group of voters that traditionally haven't worked with Corrine Brown before due to that redistricting change we were talking about earlier. So a well-respected, a formidable challenger, but it's just with the Corrine Brown situation, she's just a train wreck of a lawmaker that people have difficulty looking away, and they almost want to just keep plugging in and tuning into her situation just to see what happens next. It really is a unique phenomenon in Florida politics.
Moving on from congressional politics to presidential polling, Hillary Clinton has lost her lead in Florida, according to the latest Quinnipiac poll. Clinton and Donald Trump are now too close to call in polls from the swing states of Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Clinton lost the 8-point lead she had in the June 21st poll, with Trump now ahead within the margin of error, 42-39%. Trump's lead grows when you factor in the Libertarian and Green Party candidates. Frank, break it down for us. How does Trump take Florida in November?
Well, he has to start reaching out to the moderates and independents, specifically the moderates and independents here in the heart of the I-4 corridor in the Orlando area. It's going to take a drastic message swing. We've seen even with his recent pick of Mike Pence as a governor, Indiana Governor Mike Pence is a running mate. That's a conservative choice. He's going to have to start swinging his message towards the middle to try to win over some moderates and even disgruntled Bernie Sanders fans that feel that Hillary Clinton won't be fighting for them in Washington. So he's going to have to turn this really large personality around into and package it into a message that can win over the people that are sitting in the middle.
Florida Republicans are showing up big to support Trump. Governor Rick Scott had a quasi-endorsement before the primaries back in March, then a full endorsement after. And the likes of Pam Bondi are stepping up to the plate for the Donald. Scott and Bondi are attending the convention. Mike, how much weight do these politicos throw around with their endorsements?
Oh, endorsements? I don't know. I've never given a lot of credence to endorsements. I just don't think I think they temporarily move the needle a little bit. But, I mean, in the end, there's so many other factors, I think, that are important to people that go well beyond endorsements. I just don't think much of them.
One thing that comes to mind is Florida's Latino population. With some of the things Trump has said about immigrants and building a border wall with Mexico, Maria, can he garner support from the Latino community?
I think he would have to build a very strong bridge to the Latino community based on everything he has said thus far.
Not a wall, a bridge.
Not a wall, a bridge. Exactly. No walls, bridges. Because of the wall comments that he made from the very beginning of his candidacy and the anti-immigrant comments that he's made also from the very beginning of his candidacy, the anti-Mexican comments that he's made. Those things are pretty hard to forget. And South Florida is much more Latino, actually, than Central or North Florida is. So he's got to do some work there.
You know, speaking of the presidential candidates, the National Council of La Raza says it won't invite either presidential candidate to its conference here in Orlando later this month. The nonpartisan group advocates for Latinos on civil rights, immigration, education, other issues. They're not inviting Donald Trump because of what they call his, quote, concerted effort to denigrate and demonize not just immigrants, but the entire 55 million plus Latinos in this country. And so they won't be inviting presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Hillary Clinton either. Maria, put this in perspective. How big of it is a deal that neither of these candidates are going to be speaking to this high-profile group?
Well, for many organizations like La Raza and also the NAACP, for instance, it's always a big get for them to get a to have a big political person, candidate, speak before their group. It generally tends to generate headlines, and that puts the group, in the news as well. For La Raza and NAACP, it's also quite tricky because they are nonprofits, so they can't be too political. They can't be political at all, actually. But I think, in a way, it's a lost opportunity, in a way, because I would have loved to have heard Donald Trump speaking before a mostly Latino audience of La Raza. I think that might have been really quite interesting to hear.
Mike, really quickly, in 30 seconds, Donald Trump has made several swings through Florida, speaking at rallies on both coasts. Do you see any change in his tone on immigration as the election looms closer?
No, I haven't seen much change. I'm not sure what would motivate him to change, because whatever he's done seems to have worked. I would never presume to advise any political candidate, but it just seems like if something's working for you, then keep doing it. In this case, whether it's right or wrong, but why change now?
Thanks, everyone, for being here. You heard from our contributors, Frank Torres, Mike Lafferty, and Maria Padilla. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Support for today's show comes from Nicole Creston and Adam Mano. I'm Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.